Well, Renew, what's up this week?
Oh, gosh, this week there's something big on. There's something big on.
Is that your passport sticking out of your back pocket?
Yes. That's right. I've got my passport. I'm ready. It's how many sleeps? Two,
yeah,
three?
No, barely one, actually, because I've
and
got
a, one's
a bit
on
of,
the plane.
Exactly, and I've got quite a bit of work to do yet tonight. It's about 10 o'clock at night on Tuesday night in Melbourne, and it's EAU week. That's right.
It's EAU week. And you know, I can't bear it because there's so many of our Aussie friends already in Paris.
Is that right?
Already having the time of their lives, and you know, one more day for us.
So we're both getting on different flights out of Melbourne up to Paris tomorrow. And our studio guest, Shankar Siva, who has returned to the studio, Associate Professor Shankar Siva, Radiation Oncologist at Peter Mac, is also going to the EAU, a urology meeting.
Did you know there was urology in the title, EAU?
I did. You know, it's interesting. I am actually going out there very excited. It's my first time, so I get to actually check out the EAU to see what all the palaver is about.
I can't believe it's your first time because you've already won European Urology Paper of the Year. That was a couple of years ago. Actually. It was last year, actually. Right. Yes. And yet this is your first time.
It is. And, you know, I'm really excited, and maybe you should be on record for posterity's sake, but I'm really excited to actually catch up with urologists. So that's probably the biggest thing I'm looking forward to. There's lots of urologists I've been collaborating with, even on the editorial board for the BJUI that I've never met face-to-face. It all happened through COVID. So this is a real opportunity to get to know them and, you know, network face-to-face and see them and maybe even have a beer with them.
Well, plenty of opportunity. Declan, I heard over 10,000 people registered.
Yeah, I saw that from that email you just got from Jerica. Yeah.
So amazing.
It's a great meeting. It is very multidisciplinary. So it's obviously not all cancer, but so much of urology is cancer. But you'll see dedicated sessions combined with estro and ESMO and EANM. And it really feels like it. And a lot of the, I'm sure you already know, a lot of your favorite radiation oncologists from Europe will be there at that meeting as well. So And you'll get a great welcome.
I hope so, yeah. I've already made some plans to catch up with a couple, so particularly from the French groups and some of the Belgians, the usual suspects, but hopefully catch up with a few and meet some new people up there for the first time.
That's fantastic.
And when are you hitting the road?
I'm also leaving tomorrow night, but a different flight to you two.
Okay. All right, there we go.
Very good. We'll meet in Paris.
Yeah, well, so excuse our excitement. Yes, it is a great meeting, and it is like 24-hour flight from
it actually is.
Yeah, we head off tomorrow and get there like a day and a half later, basically. But it will be great, so we'll try and get this episode out beforehand because we hadn't really planned recording an episode tonight, had we?
No.
But there was this paper hit the airwaves just before the weekend in the JCO, so a big paper in the JCO. Lots of reaction on Twitter from urologists.
You know, I think urologists are like sharks circling the ocean and this juicy little worm just got dropped in and here they all are.
Yes.
Yes, so we had to do a podcast about it.
So what are we talking about?
Photons versus protons?
Yes, it is. So a really interesting updated article from an esteemed group in the US who've previously looked at the toxicity of proton therapy versus IMRT, your standard external beam, top of the range radiotherapy for prostate cancer. And this is quite a big debate for years and years and years. And they've published an updated paper looking at the GU and GI toxicity of proton therapy versus standard photon therapy for prostate cancer. So lots of reaction on Twitter. We were texting back and forth, Shankar, and you said, well, I think we should reach out to the first author on the paper and get
actually,
him on.
I think I said, I'm not that comfortable talking about it. Maybe we should reach out to the first author and, you know, your wish is my command.
Well, he is very comfortable talking about it.
He is. So, yeah, well, it's really good to welcome Dr. James Yu, radiation oncologist, who's joining us on Zoom. James, you are a radiation oncologist, so not a urologist like us. You actually know about this stuff at St. Francis Hospital in Hartford, Connecticut, and you're also at the Cancer Outcomes Public Policy and Effectiveness Research Center, the Copper Center at Yale, and your colleagues and yourself have put together this paper. So thank you very much for joining us.
I'm delighted to be here. Early morning, evening, I mean, you guys are world traveling and encompassing, so I'm happy to be here.
Well, it is 6 a.m., I have to say. Peter Mac, the radiation oncologist, don't get up at 6 a.m., that's for freaking sure.
Yeah, the latest is probably 7:30 for our MDT, but that's...
Yeah.
It's the first time for everything.
Actually, before I go on as well, I should say this is, we are welcoming a new partner, a new sponsor on our podcast, The Icon Cancer Centre, who are big radiation oncology providers here in Melbourne, and they've also got medical oncology branches, I think, around Australia as well. So welcome to Icon Cancer Centre, who are joining us as a partner on the podcast. So this is quite topical, and you, as well as working at Peter Mac, work at Icon as well, Shankar.
Yeah, exactly right. So I have an appointment both at Peter Mac and at Icon, and Icon is a homegrown Australian product. So it was started out of Queensland, and it's grown quite dramatically. It encompasses now medical oncology, but it's also grown in Asia. So it's now in Southeast Asia, China, and it just on, I think a couple of months ago, was announced that in the UK it's taking over some of the healthcare in Nuffield and some other areas in the UK as well. It provides excellent radiotherapy services, and a lot of patients are happy with the access. And I think, you know, in the future, hopefully it'll still be a good provider in that space in Australia and internationally.
Yeah, for sure. And in Australia, a lot of patients have private health insurance, and it's great to be able to offer both options. And Icon are the main radiation provider at the big private hospital we work at, Epworth Healthcare. So we like to continue that same team that we have at Peter Mac in the public side and at Epworth and Icon in the private side. So yeah, thank you to Icon for coming on board. And they certainly have an interest in this area, I think, new technologies in prostate cancer. So, James, can you please just give us a quick summary of this paper, and we'll put a link in the show notes as well. Tell us a little bit about what you set out to study in this paper and what you found.
Sure. So this was a study that I did with colleagues at Columbia, a terrific analyst named David DeStefano, and the senior author is one of my former colleagues, Simon Cheng. And also we had my old mentors from the Copper Center at Yale. We looked at the SEER Medicare database, the Medicaid near and dear to many of our hearts, but what it is, it's the linkage of curated registry data to Medicare claims. And so these are insurance claims plus cancer specific data. And we looked at proton radiation versus IMRT, intensity modulated radiation therapy for localized prostate cancer. And it's really an update of a study that we did about 10, 11 years ago, comparing protons and IMRT for prostate cancer. And back then in the JCO, we found no real difference between the two. There was a little bit of a signal for improved urinary toxicity at 6 months, but no real difference up to 2 years in terms of toxicity. And also, you know, Nathan Sheets and Ron Chen did a similar study with SEER Medicare back then, and they also found no big difference. We looked at a database called the Chronic Condition Warehouse back then. So fast forward to now, we were wondering, you know, there's been a lot of change in photon technology, proton technology. Is the difference going to be there, or is it not going to be there with a decade of accumulated evidence? So we matched 772 proton patients to 1,544 IMRT patients. I don't know how much you want me to get into the detail of the match, but we did everything we could to ensure that, you know, as far as we could tell, the patients were pretty similar. And, you know, the short story is we didn't really find a difference in urinary toxicity or GI-based toxicity as measured by a claim, you know, insurance claim that would be indicative of side effects.
There you go. Yeah, and maybe I suppose the world might have hoped that, well, come on, one of the putative benefits of protons is less toxicity. So is that a disappointment, Shankar, that we don't see it? And we can talk a bit about, yeah, this is a claims-based thing. It's not a prospective measure of toxicity, et cetera, but will there be disappointment in the proton community, you think?
I think there will be. I mean, this is a high-impact journal, the Journal of Clinical Oncology, and this will be a well-read article. And already on Twitter, it's caused a lot of interest. Some of the questions, I guess, you know, and maybe we can ask James this ourselves, like, is this because of old technologies, this old proton therapy compared to newer technologies with photon IMRT? But I think overall, it is a disappointing result, because you would think that with generation of technology and time, that using expensive techniques such as proton therapy might actually benefit our patients. So, I don't know, James, do you think this is just old technology and being compared to against the very state-of-the-art IMRT?
So the latest patient in our study was 2017. And so if that's old technology, then you're right. The earliest patient was 2010. There are different types of proton radiation, and that is something that we as a group are going to look at in the future, is intensity modulated proton radiation versus, non-intensity modulated proton radiation. The codes may be in there to distinguish between the two in Medicare. So that's something that we'll look at in the future. I don't think this is really an indictment of protons being bad technology. I think what it really shows is photon radiation is an absolutely terrific way to treat prostate cancer, and toxicity from photon radiation is quite low. We looked at the rates of major GI toxicity in the groups, and they were essentially zero. So really, the lack of difference was in, investigation of the urinary tract, TURP, cystoscopy, that sort of thing. So I know the proton people may be disappointed in a lack of difference, but really, I think radiation oncologists in general should be celebrating how well tolerated, at least in the claims, photon radiation seemed to be relative to proton radiation.
Yeah, it's got to be.
Yeah, it all depends on how you read it, doesn't it?
Yeah, and can we read out some of these tweets? Because they're quite entertaining. It got kicked off by our mate Scott Eginer in Chicago. Do you want to read that one, Renee?
Oh, yes. So Scott says, unless someone shows me compelling data otherwise, proton therapy for prostate cancer is yet another black eye for American healthcare.
It was a bit provocative, wasn't it? And we might put that in the show notes as well. And there was a few back and forth on that.
I did love the reply with the picture of the kid with the black eye.
The black eye, I did like that. Brian Chapin, another urologist from MD Anderson, another mate of ours. Now, Brian says, devil's advocate, if the cost was the same, would we care? And he says that the reimbursement for protons and IMRT is virtually the same. But then we saw a reply to that saying from Todd Scarborough, saying that this is wildly untrue, and he puts in some data about it. Could you clear that up for us? Because certainly our impression is proton therapy is massively, it is more expensive. But is it fully reimbursed? Are the reimbursements fully covered, or is it a lot more expensive, or even a bit more expensive than IMRT?
So it's obviously more expensive to deliver, and I don't work at a proton center, so I can't give you the absolute numbers of how expensive it is to actually deliver, but certainly the machines are more expensive, it takes much more intense physics support, that sort of thing. In terms of reimbursement, that's the weird thing about the U.S. is it really depends on the payer, right? I think Medicare reimbursement for proton radiation may be approaching similar to photons, but private insurance, depending on the payer, can be much, much more expensive. And it also depends on the state, depends on the Medicare region. So as you know, there's wide variation in payers for everything in the U.S., and proton radiation is no different. But certainly, I do think as a whole, it is more generously reimbursed than photon radiation.
Yeah, I think it's fair to say you just can't claim that it's the same cost. It's just not. You can't, it's just a much more expensive piece of tech.
Yeah.
And on that, I remember a few years ago, I think it was after your original paper, and we wrote something in the BJUI talking about the whole marketing, and we allayed it with the way urologists market robot surgery, etc. Not that we're squeaky clean on this, but I remember at that time, James, proton centers were popping up everywhere in the US, but some of them were like going bankrupt or like certainly were having financial troubles. And I think it was partly because the payers weren't really paying for prostate cancer. And I remember someone saying to me at the time that this is really good technology that works really well for certain rare cancers, I think CNS cancers or head and neck, but that it needs something like prostate cancer and breast cancer, to make it work financially. So what is the situation in the US? Do you know, are proton centers still popping up everywhere? Or is it financially challenging to run proton centers, knowing that you don't run one yourself, but you might be able to tell us a bit?
Well, so you're right. I think some of the centers that did shut down were either refurbished, old kind of research proton facilities that were very expensively refurbish to try and treat patients, or huge centers that really needed an influx of prostate cancer patients that was put in a population center where there really wasn't a huge city. So I know there are proton centers that are thriving in big cities, but you know, I think, are they popping up everywhere? The other thing that we had in the U.S. was very high insurance rates recently. And so financing of these large facilities was difficult for a while. So I do think there are going to be increasing proton centers over the next couple of years. That's just a hunch from a health economic standpoint. But is it going to be the rate of adoption that we saw a couple of years ago? I don't know. I would doubt it. You know, I think healthcare technology, as you know, is adopted in an S curve, right? There's an initial phase of adoption, there's rapid, and then there's kind of a plateauing. And a couple years ago, I thought we were on the steep part of the curve. I think probably now we're approaching that plateau. So we'll see. That would be an interesting study for us to do in about 5 years.
He says probably.
And James, you know, your initial paper was, like you said, 10, 11 years ago. Do you have longer term follow-up in these patients who've had proton therapy?
Yeah, so we could have looked back at the old paper. That's a great idea, actually, and done the 5-6 year follow-up on that. And maybe we'll do that. But no, we intentionally looked at a 2-year follow-up range for our patients, because we wanted to have as many patients as possible. The longer the follow-up, the further back you have to cut off your patients. But there is certainly long-term follow-up data, I think, from the multi-institutional level. Most of us think that major, you know, urinary bowel toxicity after radiation, while you can have it in the late phase, typically most of it's within the first couple of years of treatment.
And there is a big randomized trial, isn't there? You reference it in the paper, the particle quality of life study, which I understand is a very much anticipated multi-center randomized trial that's been running, I think you said, for more than 10 or 11 years and is not due to read out for another 2 or 3 years. So it's always the thing with localized prostate cancer. It takes a long time to get your outcomes, and almost everything has changed in the meantime. But can you tell us anything about that study? You're not involved, but you refer to it in the paper. Will that really seal the deal on protons?
Yeah, well, I mean, I don't know if it'll seal the deal. I mean, because again, as you guys know, with the technology with a trial that runs that long, you worry that, you know, the original patients in that study won't be representative of the patients at the end of that study. But, you know, kudos, Herculean effort to Justin Beckelman, Jason Estathiou, the PIs of that study, for keeping the faith both of them are really great researchers and honest brokers. And I think, you know, whatever that study shows, that I think will trump observational data. I think, and so we'll see what it shows. I do believe whatever results come out of that will be, you know, expertly presented for sure.
That's very generous of you. Now, we wanted to, in wrapping up, talk about the local situation, Shankar. Myself and Renu were down in Adelaide recently for the USANS ASM. So Adelaide is one of Australia's smaller cities. It's our fifth largest city, a lovely city on the south coast. So at the moment, there are no proton therapy facilities in Australia. But Adelaide have been the city that has, you know, put the most effort in. They've put a lot of funding into developing a proton centre.
A beautiful building that's been coming up for a couple of years,
in the middle of the academic health research place called the Bragg Centre. And I think it was slated to open like in 2 years' time, $500 million Australian dollar project, and I suppose would be effectively the national centre, although here in Victoria we've had a project, I don't think it's really up and running. But while we were down in Adelaide a few weeks ago, all over the papers are, you know, gigantic financial disaster. It's all over the main media down there. There's all sorts of statements being released, and they've apparently got some issues with the supplier of this technology from the US, who looks like they were like going to fall over by the look of some of the reports. And I read in the paper last week that there's a minimum like $100 million bailout from the taxpayer necessary, it said in the media this week. to get that centre ever up and running. They're going to have to bail out the original technology. So what is the landscape in Australia with having said all that to you?
It's a very interesting question. And, you know, in a way, the Bragg Centre or Adelaide, although it's the fifth largest city, is actually the spiritual home or should be for proton therapy. Bragg Peak is actually a description of a dosimetric property of protons for proton therapy. It describes a very sharp drop-off on the radiation dose,
yeah,
right?
I knew that.
And Bragg's from Adelaide, so that makes sense. But there's been issues because the provider that Adelaide went with didn't really have a huge track record of delivering these machines before. And so they've run into some issues with their pipeline and delivery and actually executing and delivering on time. And this is an ongoing issue. So at the moment in Australia, there are several centres that are kind of vying to open a proton facility. Adelaide is well in advance of everyone else. And variably, depending on where you are in the Eastern Seaboard, this kind of changes from a government and federal and state level, whether this is going to be Queensland, New South Wales, or even Peter Mac and Royal Melbourne and the Royal Children's Hospital precinct in Victoria. So none of those three are finalised, and even the Adelaide one is looking kind of shaky at the moment. Mm. But hopefully we'll execute, because at the moment we are actually sending quite a few patients or paediatric patients to the US for treatment with proton therapy, which is exorbitantly expensive to get them there in the first place and then deliver that type of treatment. And if we had a homegrown facility, particularly for paediatric patients, I think it'd be very helpful for the community. The problem is, how do you run a centre like that in a viable manner? And, you know, personally, I don't think prostate and breast will be high up on the list. These are really useful technologies for things like lung and head and neck re-irradiation, lung re-irradiation, CNS, base of skull, as we mentioned before. These are really good niche uses for proton therapy that have very obvious dosimetric advantages that we can take advantage of. The issue with prostate, just from a physical perspective, from my point of view, and this is coming from someone who doesn't have proton experience, so, you know, take that with a grain of salt, but the issues are limited by the beam delivery being often opposed beams rather than multi-step or arc-based therapies that we do on photon linear accelerators nowadays, and also image guidance. We just don't have the same level of image guidance on most of the proton machines. So eventually the cost will come down, and eventually we'll have even heavier particles, things like carbon and helium and heavier particles that will come through. But the big barrier at the moment still cost. It's kind of getting that tipping point where the threshold will be smaller and the rooms that are required are much smaller as well. So hopefully we'll see something come around the corner soon.
And that's really key, isn't it? Because if it did get going in Australia, for prostate cancer at least, this is going to either happen in the private sector or self-funded. And right now we just don't have enough evidence for prostate cancer that it's worth it.
And James's paper means we'll have to wait a little bit longer, I suspect. And because of that story we just told you, James, I think local governments here, you know, they've got the frighteners on them as well, which is disappointing, because I think we all agree it would be really good to have one of these facilities in a country the size of Australia. Probably maybe one set of servicing the country would be a reasonable thing to do. And hopefully we will get one up and running, at least in an academic sense. And
because if not for prostate cancer, for there prostate, are lots exactly, of other, you know, and, yeah, areas where it would be very beneficial.
And in our sort of...
I agree completely. You know, I mean, it's proton radiation is a terrific technology, and it's absolutely terrific technology. And there are positive randomized clinical trials supporting proton radiation for other disease sites. You know, recently there was, you know... craniospinal proton radiation improves, you know, outcomes compared to, you know, focused photon beam, for example. I think Jonathan Yang out of Sloan Kettering, now he's in Seattle, and Aaron Gillespie, there was a great study. And these come out every day. It's just prostate may not be the target. The other really big point I want to make about the paper is that we do a terrific job, Shankar and I, treating prostate cancer with a photon beam. You know, I don't want it to be an indictment of radiation oncology or a black eye for radiation oncology. Yeah. It's really, this tool here is maybe not be the exact right one to apply it to prostate cancer.
You've said absolutely, that twice already in the podcast, and I couldn't agree more with you. And we hinted at before, you know, we get asked this question. I'm sure in the US it's a lot more topical, but we occasionally get asked, patients will be newly diagnosed, come for second opinions. what about proton therapy? And at the moment, it's easy to say, well, it's not available in this country, et cetera, et cetera. And I have had one patient who's self-funded to go to Singapore because we have protons up there now and has done very well. But for most patients, we can still reassure them and say the conventional photon therapy-based radiotherapy that you will receive in this country for your prostate cancer is absolutely fantastic, and these are the data. And I think that this paper does contribute to that reassurance.
Absolutely, and I think that's why it's so important that you as a radiation oncologist did this study, because it shows a level of insight to look at your own practices and compare them.
Yeah, this is good.
Yeah, and to Declan's point about the patient who moved to, she was treated in Singapore from Australia. In the last paper, we found a very interesting kind of U-shaped curve of likelihood of getting proton radiation. If you live right next door to a proton center, you were more likely to get it. But if you lived really far away for some reason, you were also more likely to get it than the middle people. And it was because it was those medical tourists with a whole lot of money that were traveling to very far away for treatment.
I love it. And the other, finally on it as well, and you hint at this in the paper, is that within photon therapy for prostate cancer, we're also now looking at very hypofractionated regimens, which are very attractive to patients, and SBRT as primary. You know, so the whole technology is evolving really, really, really quickly in the photon era, which I suppose that'll have to be considered when the randomized trial reads out. But wouldn't you, I mean, we've had you on the podcast many times talking about this over the last 4 years, Shankar, but that's true as well. This is not a standstill area, photon therapy for prostate cancer, on the contrary.
Yeah, absolutely. And mostly, and James might correct me if I'm incorrect here, but most of the data for proton therapy has not been the hypofractionated era. It's mostly fully fractionated treatments, mostly 2 or 1.8 gray per fraction and very long courses of treatment. So translating this out immediately into hypofractionated treatments, it should be translatable, you'd think, but I'm just not aware of that much data around at the moment.
Is that true, James? And actually on Twitter, on that Twitter thread, I also saw someone saying, I don't know, is that true, that if you have proton therapy, you have to have a rectal balloon in, like they used to use on MRI scanners in the old days. But I'm not sure if that's true or not. But, you know, somebody was commenting it's a kind of uncomfortable experience for the patient to have one of these balloons in as well. So
I don't think
we actually looked at fractionation schemas in one of our appendices. There was a group that did get moderate hypofractionation in the proton group. But you're absolutely right. The 5-fraction treatment, fewer fraction treatment, SBRTs, we'll have to compare those two specifically, I think, between protons and photons. But then the other elephant in the room, I think, is MR based technology and MR Linacs. The era that we evaluated was probably in the earliest adoption of MR Linac based therapy. And we know there's a randomized study, right? The Mirage study that suggests that MR Linac with the smaller margins may actually be better in terms of quality of life compared to photon therapy with a slightly larger margin.
I might have wrote the editorial for that one.
You might have written the editorial. He says, thumping his own chest. Well, look, that's fantastic. I really enjoyed that. I feel very well.
But you know what, Declan? What I've learned from this, I think we just need a urologist to take over the marketing for protons. Don't we need like a Leonardo proton or a proton knife or something like that? A robotic proton therapy. That's what we need next.
James, come on. We're talking to the guy who comes up with the best names for all of his trials as well. You know, he's got a pop star and...
If urologists were marketing proton therapy, then you'd have to buy a new couch every 10 treatments.
I love it. I love it. That was a fantastic discussion.
Awesome, James.
What a great way to sign ourselves off before the EAU. Absolutely. Thanks so much to James for getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning over in Connecticut. And you, Shankar, for staying up late at night. You have to go home now and pack. Off to Europe tomorrow. Have you packed?
I've packed. I'm ready. Yeah. Passport's in the pocket. Yeah. Going straight to the airport. No.
Yeah. No, I've got a day's work to do tomorrow, unfortunately, and a few videos to edit tonight. Ahead of the EAU. So, so thanks so much, James. Congrats on the very nice work.
Yeah, you and your colleagues.
And keep up your interest in this area. The Copper Center obviously produced some really good work. And it's been a real privilege to have you on. Thank you very much for joining us, I must say.
It's been really fun being on. You guys are awesome. And thanks for your interest in the paper, as always. And Shankar, I'll see you later.
See you soon.
And Shankar, thank you much for joining us, and thank you to Icon for also supporting us and coming on to GUcast as partners. We really appreciate it, everyone at Icon Cancer Centre. And that's all we got time for here on GUcast. We're going to sign off and talk to you from the EAU, I think.